Ventura, California during the first annual Kapow Intergalactic Film Festival October 6th through 9th. With a portion of the proceeds benefiting the Wayne Foundation. Visit KapowIFF.com for more information on how to submit your project. That's KapowIFF.com.
And here's your fun fact. What's the smartest snack for a long drive? Nuts. That's your best bet. I like that they provide filling protein and come in small serving packages. You don't want to mindlessly binge on an entire bag of chips. Jerky, cheese sticks, and fruit are good too. Drink water and coffee and avoid anything sugary. Stay tuned to Inspirato Projecto for more fun facts.
We're about to sing People Are Strange for your entertainment. It is Angel One. You're about to hear People Are Strange. With Dizzy Black on drums, CEC on vocals, or Vox, depending on how French you are.
Oh, that's loud.
That's loud. That's loud.
Okay, that's a little better. Was I screaming in your ears? Here I am.
Hello.
You do without those?
What do you prefer?
I like to be able to hear my... Sometimes I'm like, wow, they're really, really, really loud on here. Today is... we're calling the episode of this... We're titling this Perceptions. We have today in the studio... We have Jeff Finn, who wrote Before the End. We had him in here before, but I want to talk to him more about The Doors and Jim Morrison and have him geek out here with Elisa Jordan, who does the Ella Woman tours all around Los Angeles. So she takes people to all these sometimes well-known, sometimes obscure locations to show folks different areas that Jim Morrison used to hang out at and the Doors. One thing I want to ask you, Jeff, was what were your beginning inspirations with Jim Morrison or the Doors? What started you down this rabbit hole?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for having me on again. I greatly appreciate it, and I am also a fan. I'm not only a client.
Thank you.
Let's see. I first heard the Doors when I was a very little kid. My older cousins would play them. So I think I was around 4 or 5 years old. I remember distinctly hearing Light My Fire, Riders in the Storm, various Doors songs in my cousin's garage as he would work on his car. And then flashes forward and little bits and pieces there through the years. There was another time when I was a freshman in high school, driving back. I was a competitive swimmer at the time, and I was driving back with some other swimmers from a cross interstate swim meet in the back seat of a car. And I'll never forget, the guy in the front seat, the older kid, pulled out a cassette, The Doors' Greatest Hits, and plugged it in the deck. And sort of my whole world changed, you know. And the contact high didn't hurt either from the front seat, from the joint that was being passed. And then on and on. It was just different stages. Yeah, I can get to those later. So
Lisa, what started out your investigations into Jim Morrison and the Doors?
Well, thanks for having me, first of all.
You're welcome.
I was also very young. I was about 6, and that was the year that MTV started, so you can probably guess exactly how old I am. But it was 1981, and at the time, MTV didn't have enough videos to fill the airtime. So they had something that was called Closet Classics, and they would play old footage from... a lot of times, the Ed Sullivan Show. And so I learned a lot about old Who footage and the Stones, and one that they used to play a lot was the Doors on Ed Sullivan when they sang Light My Fire, and I had never heard anything like it, and I was just mesmerized by the sound and all the members, and I just kind of never looked back, and one of the things that I can kind of figure out now is, you know, I think Jim Morrison was probably my first crush in a very innocent little kid kind of a way. But that's what started it, and I've been going ever since.
Where did you take your first step in deciding to do a tour? I mean, what was the first, I guess, location that inspired you to go, hey, you know what, ooh, cool, let's gather all the locations?
Well, I've always been kind of a nerd, and I've always been really into local history. And being a third-generation Southern Californian, I sometimes get my panties in a wad when people say that there's no history in the area. And really, there's history on every corner. It's just people don't pay attention to it, or they don't want to give credit where credit is due. So since I was a kid, I've liked finding where certain things happened. And I have a real fascination for especially going into buildings where certain things happen. So walking into the Whiskey A Go-Go for the first time was very exciting to me, knowing who had been in those walls, not just the Doors, but everyone that you can think of in music history has been in those four walls. And as a kid and then as a teenager, as I learned how to drive, I would go find sites all over the place for various people. And a few years ago...
So sorry, I accidentally... press a button here. I don't know what that did. Talk? Wait, can you keep talking real quick?
Yep.
Oh, there it is. Okay,
so,
good.
When I was a teenager, I started kind of gathering locations of all kinds of things. And a few years ago, well, I guess several years ago now, I was the Marilyn Monroe expert on a couple of websites, and I realized that for as famous as she is, a lot of people don't know a lot about her. So I started thinking, well, maybe I could just make a classroom on wheels and take people to where places she had gone. And shortly thereafter, I realized, well, hey, I know a lot about the Doors, too. I could probably do a second tour. So I started working on both of them at the same time. And that's kind of how it started. And I thought that I knew a lot about the Doors, and I guess I did, but once I started really digging into what it would take to build a tour, which I had never done before, I just kind of fell down this Hollywood rabbit hole of what inspired them, where, and how it all came together, because the Doors are one of those bands where Los Angeles is almost a character that runs through their music. They couldn't have come from any other city. So the city is imperative to understanding the band, and that's kind of the basis of the tour.
How many locations do you visit?
Oh, gosh, over 50 or 60.
And you do that in one day, in one tour?
Yeah, it's a long tour, though. So if you're a casual Doors fan, you'll learn a lot. If you're a hardcore Doors fan, you'll be very happy. If you have a small bladder, you might want to reconsider. But it's very thorough, and it's the tour that I would want if I were coming to Los Angeles and wanted to learn more about the Doors.
Are there any obscure things that you've heard? I can only assume that there are probably some people who have gone on your tour who might have actually been friends with Jim or any of the Doors, or people who are like, ooh, you know what, I got a little something to tell you. Here's a little, you know, here's something you might not know about yet.
I haven't had that yet, although I have had people say they would get in touch with others who know about them. The closest I can come to that was actually before I was doing the tours, and I was a student at UCLA in the late 90s. And I was really into romantic literature at the time. And for those of you who aren't familiar with romantic literature, the name of it doesn't do it justice. It's actually a very revolutionary type of poetry. And I studied under a guy named Fred Berwick at UCLA. And he had been Jim Morrison's professor when Jim was a student at UCLA. That was his first year teaching, and he was teaching a Robert Blake class that year. And of course, if you go back to the origin of the name of the Doors, they took it from Huxley, who took it from Blake. So this is the origins of where Jim was really learning about Robert Blake, and I was studying under the same professor. So that was very cool. And one of the things that I can't remember how Jeff and I first got in touch, but that was one of the first things I told him was, Fred Berwick is an untapped resource. You have to get in touch with him and interview him for your movie.
That's cool. Was he able to, did he hold on to any of Jim's poems throughout all those years? He's like, oh my God, this is the dude in the Doors.
No, I asked him, do you still have his paper that he wrote for you? And he said, no, well, I graded it and gave it back. But a few years later, when Jim was writing poetry books, he autographed a couple of his books and sent them to him and said something like, hey, prof, what do you think of this poetry? And signed it, Jim Morrison.
That's really cool. So, Jeff, what was the... I want to ask you about your documentary before the end. What was the... who was the first person that you can remember going out and interviewing, or actually like getting the guts to go, okay, you know what, I want to put this movie together, I want to show this untold story, this whole side of him that nobody really knows about yet. Who was the first person that you go, okay, let's go to this person?
Well, the first thought that came to mind was Jim's brother and sister, Ann and Andy Morrison, younger brother and younger sister. And I did eventually interview Andy for the film, and I'm really thrilled with that and grateful, because it's the first time he's ever done an on-camera interview for a documentary or otherwise. Anne is another story, which we can get in a little later. But as far as the first person I spoke with, it was actually Mary Werbelow, who was Jim's college-era girlfriend in Florida. And Mary later followed him out to UCLA, to Los Angeles. And she proved to be a huge inspiration, even though they eventually parted. She was an inspiration for, you know, many of his lyrics and poetry work as well. So she was the first one I spoke with at length, and that was like a three 3.5 hour discussion in person, mind-boggling for me, you know, as a huge, as a hardcore fan, to be sitting there in the sun talking to Mary. Unfortunately, you know, and I'm not the first one to bring this to the public's attention. Mary, she endured some health issues over the years, and by her own admission, is not really, in a good place to, appear on camera or that kind of thing. But she was very kind to me to share some information, you know, off the camera, as it were. So, but she was the first one I spoke with, and I thought that was apropos. It was very inspiring to then continue my momentum moving forward. And very shortly after, it was almost like a domino effect. I think I interviewed Andy Morrison about 2 months later, and a number of people Jim went to UCLA with, and just on and on from there.
You have a funny story about meeting Jim's brother. You don't have to give away any locations or anything, but can you? It's just awesome and mysterious.
That he lives on the moon?
Well, that he lives in the moon, and how you got there.
I'm being completely facetious there. No, but he does live off the grid, I will say that.
What'd you have to go through in order to...
I was going to say, how do I balance this one?
It's like an Indiana Jones adventure, really.
I mean, honestly, in making this film, I keep joking that I'm like the punk rock Sherlock Holmes or something. You know, a DIY detective. I've really just worked so hard in terms of research, which had already, you know, been a strong suit of mine. But I just dug deep to find information. And at the time, I had gathered that Andy, Jim's brother Andy Morrison, was living in Hawaii. So that's where I started digging. And I did, in fact, find... that he still maintained a residence there, from what I could gather, but that he wasn't physically living there anymore. He was then in this other area that I can't mention, you know, sort of off the grid. And what makes it doubly interesting, in my opinion, you flash forward from October of 2012, when I finally did interview Andy, to I think it was March of 2014 when I interviewed Jack Holzman. Jack Holzman is the founder and president of Elektra Records, the Doors record label, for those in the know, and now those not in the know. And so when I interviewed Jack, among other questions, I said, hey, okay, so, you know, whatever your stance on Jim allegedly faking his death, say he did, hypothetically, if Jim did fake his death, and stranger things have happened in this world, did he have enough money to live on indefinitely? And Holzman looked me right in the eye on camera and said, yes, he did. So I said, okay. And then he's describing the aftermath of when Jim allegedly died in July 3rd, 1971, at the age of 27 in Paris. And Jack then said to me, and I'll do my Jack Holzman impression, and I'm pretty proud of it. I just want to point that out for what it's worth. So, you know, you can agree or not, but he said, I sent Bill Harvey, who was sort of a loose second in command, to Hawaii. I mean, to Hollywood, to take care of matters there. And I almost said, "Whoa, could you back up there, Jack? What did you just say?" And then I had to continue with the rest of the interview. And then later, I got home and checked the playback. And sure enough, he said in my normal Jeff voice, he said, "I sent Bill Harvey, a loose second in command, to Hawaii. I mean, to Hollywood." To take care of, you know, the matters there. So it's one of those little nuggets where you later find out, you know, yes, Andy was there. You know, could Jim have done this? It goes on and on. The fake death is a whole other matter that we can get into when that's apropos for you.
Oh, yeah, we'll get back. We'll get to that a little bit later.
Let me say the alleged fake death.
For now, I want to play something called the Celebrity Afterlife Report, where it's the celebrity medium. He has many contacts with the paparazzi, the afterlife paparazzi. He has a lot of inside sources about the hottest gossip of some of the celebrities that have gone into the afterlife. And in today's program, we just might come across someone familiar. So here we go.
Greetings. Earth, fellow Earthlings. This is Jeff Finn, director of Strange September's The Hill Abduction and the Exeter Encounter, and you're listening to Inspirato Projecto Radio on K-Tong 1630 on your AM dial. Are you curious about advanced extraterrestrial beings, UFOs? Then check out my independent documentary film by going to StrangeSeptembers.com or head directly to Vimeo.com and search Strange Septembers. In the meantime, take, if you will, my prize-winning impression of Cesar Romero's Joker.
Here's your fun fact. The word vagina means sheath or scabbard in Latin, suggesting that love and war have been connected for thousands of years. Stay tuned to Inspirato Projecto for more fun facts.
Celebrity Afterlife Report Podcast.
After a week off for Labor Day, I'm back. They're ready to give you another episode of the Celebrity Afterlife Report, the only show on the internet that brings you the up-to-the-minute gossip about all your favorite deceased celebs. Who am I? The Celebrity Medium. Course. Now, although we were off last week, that doesn't mean I wasn't in touch with my next world paparazzi contacts. There's always something going on in the afterlife celebrity scene, and I have stories to pass along to you. The biggest name to transition to his new existence over the past 2 weeks is Gene Wilder, the much-beloved image actor is best known for his film work with Mel Brooks and Richard Pryor. Upon his arrival to the next world, he was greeted with a very large crowd, which was very happy to see him, I'm told. My contacts tell me that Gene seemed very touched by the loving reception he got. He was even happier and one of the big shock factors for him when his former wife, Gilda Radner, ran up to him and gave him a big hug. Gilda threw her arms around him and kissed him. Something odd happened. Sources tell me that Gene seemed a bit awkward at that point and didn't return the hug or the kiss. He was smiling somewhat sheepishly at Gilda before taking the opportunity to make a short speech to the assembled crowd, saying how happy he was to see everyone and thanking them for greeting him so warmly. After that, Gilda took his hand and led him off, presumably to her home. Apparently, stood at arm's length from her as they walked off. Those who noticed his behavior were understandably confused by it. Later, Princess Diana, who has become my best-known afterlife source, managed to catch up with the couple, and she got to interview them for a TV gossip show. In the interview, Gene said he was extremely happy to see Gilda, but he felt awkward as he had remarried after she transitioned to the next world. He felt as if he was cheating on his earthly plane spouse by showing affection to his former wife. Both Gilda and Diana told him that was very sweet and understandable, but that there was no reason for him to feel guilty, as people often run into loved ones from earlier in their earthly plane existences when they arrive in the afterlife, and that it was perfectly acceptable there for him to resume his relationship with Gilda. Gene said he was very relieved to know that, but it was going to take him a while to adjust to how things are there. In in this next story, things get a little strange, as they often do in the next world. Although Gene Wilder left the earthly plane almost 2 weeks ago, he didn't actually arrive in the afterlife for several days. And no one knows why, but that happens fairly often, so it's nothing to be concerned about. As it turns out, he arrived just before conservative firebrand Phyllis Schlafly did. Many credit anti-feminist Schlafly for the Equal Rights Amendment never becoming law. While Wilder was on stage accepting the accolades of his many fans in the next world, Schlafly was waiting her turn in the spotlight. And apparently she couldn't see what was going on out in front from where she was standing. So when Gene left the reception area with Gilda Radner, Schlafly walked onto the raised stage-like platform, seemingly expecting the same kind of raucous greeting he had received. What she didn't know until she reached the microphone was that the crowd dissipated immediately after Gene and Gilda walked away. Waiting for Schlafly was a much smaller crowd, mostly composed of people who were just waiting for the street to clear out. I'm told she was visibly irritated and expressed her indignation to the few stragglers still left, saying that Wilder had stolen her thunder. Later, to a reporter, she said she was absolutely sure that her disappointing reception was a plot by, quote, liberal Hollywood types, unquote, to make her look bad. Now, I wasn't there, of course, but I'm sorry, I have to say she sounds paranoid and more than a little delusional. Longtime listeners know about the problems singer Jim Morrison, formerly of The Doors, has had in the next world. It's a long story, so I won't go into it in a lot of detail right now. If you want to know about it, I suggest you check out some of the older episodes of the report. The Reader's Digest version is that Jim was kicked out of the Legends, the afterlife band he formed along with Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, and other rock and roll luminaries. After that, he formed his own band called The Real Legends, which turned out to be himself with impersonators of the other musicians from the original Legends band. When that didn't go well for him, to say the least, the audiences were really PO'd when they saw what the real Legends consisted of. He tried his hand at several other showbiz jobs, only to be fired or just quit them. Things seemed to be turning around for the Lizard King when he performed at a huge all-star show in Environment, the indoor amusement area where afterlife citizens can go to experience a rainy day. Looked like his career was headed in the right direction again, but we haven't actually heard anything about Morrison since that show. We may now know why. Stories are starting to emerge from some of the other performers at that show that Jim was his usual diva-ish self backstage, demanding to have special lighting on him while he sang and so forth. That doesn't appear to have sat well with the others on the bill. So if Jim had any hopes of working with them in the future, they appear to have been ruined by his over-the-top demands. Now comes word that, incredibly, Morrison is trying to put together another version of The Real Legends. He has run ads looking for lookalikes of Hendrix, Joplin, and other rock greats. People are reportedly amazed he would try this tack again, given how spectacularly it flopped the first time around. Hugh O'Brien was a Hollywood actor in his day, well known for starring in the life and legend of Wyatt Earp and another show called Search on television. He also had a notable supporting role in John Wayne's last film, The Shootist, as well as many other movies. He arrived in the next world on the 5th of September. His welcome wasn't as large as some other celebrities have been, as he hasn't been active in show business in recent years. Apparently, though, he is more than ready to get back into the saddle again. My sources tell me that immediately upon his arrival, O'Brien went around glad-handing everyone in sight, saying, "Hi, I'm Hugh O'Brien, actor. Can you work for me?" I'm told that his good looks and charm won people over immediately, but what my sources told me, I can't imagine it will take long for you to be back on either the small or large screen again. So I'm just going to say best of luck, Mr. O'Brien. Okay, looking at my notes, I see that's all I have for you at the moment. I'll be back next week with more up-to-the-minute gossip about all your favorite deceased celebs. And I really hope you'll be here to join me. In the meantime, it would be greatly appreciated if you would tell your friends, family, and loved ones that the report can be found on iTunes, in the Google Play Store, and on Kaechung, 1630 a.m. in Los Angeles. And, of course, it's free wherever you find it. I'm the Celebrity Medium. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Celebrity Afterlife Report podcast. To ask a question about your favorite deceased celebrity, call 818-3-MY-DREAM. 818-3-MY-DREAM. 818-369-3732.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are back. Just want to point out a couple of things you've heard since the beginning of the program. You've heard the Kapow advertisement. October 6th through the 9th is the Kapow Intergalactic Film Festival, the inaugural, the very first one ever. We'd love to see you out there. There's going to be a lot of great movies. Also, at the top of the program, you heard People Are Strange, sung on Rock Band by Dory and me. Also, you heard the Strange Septembers promo for that movie. Phenomenal movie, phenomenal documentary by Jeff Finn, who happens to be in the studio with us today. Also, you heard an advertisement for Rio. The next Rio show, the Duran Duran tribute show, it's happening October 1st at the Federal Bar. Check that out. That's North Hollywood. And of course, we heard the newest Celebrity Afterlife report, and he's once again reporting on Jim Morrison and The Real Legends, which is the band that he's putting together. I can't believe he's trying to do this again. He didn't fool anyone the first time, and now he's trying to do it again, putting a bunch of impersonators in there. We're back here. We got Elisa Jordan in here, who gives the LA Woman tours. Also, Jeff Finn, who's putting together a documentary before the end. So, Elisa, I wanted to ask you about. And then we're going to do a Skype. We're going to do a Skype call here soon. But I just want to ask you real quick. Okay, so what was the first location that you had picked out for your tour when you first decided, okay, I'm going to do a tour here?
Oh, definitely the Whiskey. That's kind of where it all started. That's ground zero for the Doors as far as I'm concerned. So the Whiskey A Go-Go is where everyone wants to see. And the second place I knew I had to go was Venice Beach.
Mm.
People always ask if I go to Venice Beach. They don't know what they want to see when they get there, but they know that they have to go to Venice Beach. So it's the Whiskey A Go-Go and Venice Beach.
Now, that building, you've probably seen it. There's a huge painting of Jim Morrison up there upon.
Uh-huh.
Is there any truth to the rumor, or maybe I'm making up the rumor, that he actually slept on the roof of that building at some point?
It's not that building. It's another building.
Oh, you know which one?
Yeah, I know which one. That's one of the places that we actually stop and get out and look around. But kind of an interesting trivia note about that painting. It's done by a guy named Rip Kronk, I think his name is. And he's a very popular muralist in Venice Beach. And when he painted that mural, he used Jim's face, of course, but the body part is actually a self-portrait. That's not Jim's body. That's the artist's own body.
So that's crazy.
Yeah.
Wow, what an interesting piece of knowledge. It's a Frankenstein.
Yep.
That's incredible. So, okay, so first you had the Whiskey, then you got Venice Beach. How did you come across all these other locations that you thought were, oh, that's where we need to go next?
Well, if you're into the Doors and you like Los Angeles history like I do, you know that the corner of Santa Monica and La Cienega is a hotbed of Doors sites. That's where the Doors office was, the rehearsal studio, and where they ended up recording the album L.A. Woman. And a lot of things are within walking distance for Jim because he lost his license, his driver's license at one point. So you had the bar down the street where he liked to hang out, which has since been torn down. The liquor store across the street where the guys would go get their booze. There's a hotel, a couple of former strip clubs, restaurants, all kinds of things that he used to walk to. So I knew that was going to be a big focal point.
So during the LA Woman tour, during the tour, do you actually stop at these places? Like, are people actually able to have a drink in one of these bars, or is there just not enough time? Because it sounds like you got a whole bunch of places you're going to.
Yeah, there's not enough time to stop and get a drink. Although we do stop and get out at a couple of locations because I feel very strongly that in order to appreciate some of the history we're trying to get across, you have to get out and experience it and interact with it. So we have been very lucky about getting into the Whiskey A Go-Go. There always seems to be someone there who's willing to let us in, so hopefully I'm not jinxing anything, but thank you to the people at the Whiskey A Go-Go who always let us in, and thank you to the people at the office, whatever restaurant is currently the current incarnation there. They've always been really sweet about letting us in and letting us walk around so you can see where they recorded, where you can see the bathroom where Jim would do his vocals because the reverb was better in the bathroom.
Wow.
So we can actually see the bathroom and point it out. So there's a lot where you get to get out and kind of interact in his world, so to speak.
This is fantastic. Okay, we're going to dial up. Oops, that's not the one. I'm going to dial up Dory right now. We're going to see if she can. You guys will be able to see her. The at-home viewers cannot see her, but you guys could actually talk to her. She's going to have some questions. Let's see here. Oh, there we go. Hey, Dory. Wait, hold on. Go ahead, say something. Let me see if I have your volume okay.
Hello.
Oh, wait. Oh, gosh. Okay, I know what's happening. I know exactly what's happening. I know what's going on. All right, hold on a second. I have my iTunes still running. Oh, there we go. Okay, can you say something really quick?
Something.
Oh, good. Can you guys hear her okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So, Dory, can you see them?
Okay. I can. My screen's really small, but I see. Yes, hi.
So that's Elisa.
I'm the girl.
And this is Jeff.
Hi, Elisa. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Dory.
This is Dory right here. So, Dory, do you have any specific questions that you'd like to ask them? Elisa does the tours around Los Angeles. Jeff, of course, is doing the documentary.
Yes. Okay, so I just got home, so I don't know what I've missed. I have questions for both of you. Elisa, how long have you been doing the tours for?
Since 2012.
Since 2012. Okay, so next time I'm in California, I should come on your tour.
Well, I do them in the summertime, so if you're here in the summer, try to get in touch
summer
with me.
Summer only.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, summer's a good time to be there.
Yeah.
And Jeff, so weird that you know Kurt, because I've been following your page for about a year and a half now, and
discovered a week ago
for your documentary.
Yeah.
And just discovered about a week ago that you and Kurt are friends. So that was a little odd.
It's a small world after all.
Indeed. So you've interviewed Jim's brother.
Yes. Yes.
Along with others. Okay.
Yes. I've actually, as I was just telling Kurt again off mic about an hour ago, I've communicated with over 700 people now who are connected to Jim. And of those 700 plus, it's like 720 something. 109 of them have been interviewed on camera, and obviously I won't be able to fit all 109 of those amazing interviews into the film, but there are some other things in the works in terms of an extended cut, shall we say, that might dial in those other interviews, so, yeah.
Right, I'm wondering, can I ask you questions without giving anything away in your documentary? Well, you can just tell me no.
Yeah, feel free. Ask anything.
Any reason why, did you get any answers as to why the family wasn't contacted or even knew what was going on until their first album was released?
Yes and yes.
Yes and yes. Okay.
How's that?
Okay, so that's about it. So that'll be covered.
Yeah, I get to that. We go there, for sure. And no, you know, I'm being half facetious there, but I mean, a lot of it honestly was just Jim being Jim, in my opinion.
Right.
You know, he. If there's anything I've learned in the making of this film, and I knew that pretty well beforehand, actually being a hardcore fan, you know, Jim lived a very compartmentalized existence. You know, for better or worse, he kept certain conglomerations of friends here and other groups of friends there and lovers here, and he also loved to just get away and disappear. You know, back in the pre-internet, pre-cell phone days when you could do that. You could just go off the grid, and, you know, he would literally vanish for, you know, a weekend here, a whole week there, and he loved it. He loved to just be able to get the hell out of Dodge, as it were, you know, and so the thing with the family, I mean, that's, you know, we're not reinventing the Morrison wheel there with Before the End. You know, it's well documented that Jim had a major schism with his family, you know, with his parents in particular.
Really. His father. Yeah.
And the mother, too. And, you know, the reasons why, we get into that in the film.
Right. Cool. Mike, I have a little bit of a hard time listening to you guys. If I turn it up, does it turn me up, too?
Does this sound better? You hear me better now?
Oh, you know what? She can't hear you in the microphone. She's hearing you through a little tiny microphone on this laptop. So, yeah, Dora, I think if you turn up your computer, ideally, hopefully, you should be able to... Or
okay,
if you got earbuds, maybe you'll be able
am
to hear
Am I too
them.
Loud now?
No, you sound good. It sounds good.
Oh, okay, perfect. And I can hear you better, too.
Oh, yeah.
So what did I miss?
Well, you... what questions do... Okay, so this is a good time, actually, Jeff, for you to talk about the little... Some of the giblets of information that you're able to talk about when we're having breakfast today.
Giblet is a wonderful
in
word.
In terms of the little morsels and giblets that have to do with people... accidentally slipping up and saying that, you know, maybe Morrison faked his death and stuff.
Right. Well, I can tell you, I mean, you know, no pussyfooting about it. I mean, I've dedicated my whole life to making this film for the last 4 years straight, and I've been studying Jim's life since I first read this book, No One Here Gets Out Alive, which you can't see there, in 1985.
I can see it.
Oh, yeah, you can see it. There you go. So... Yeah, I'm not, and we can say that on K-Chung, right? We can go there and say, I'm not fucking around,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah,
right.
You can say that.
As opposed to, I'm not beeping around. So, yeah, I'm going for it. I'm not, life's too short, and the planet might not be spinning for too much more, terribly long, who knows? So, while we're here, while we're relatively young on this planet, I want to, you know, get some, the closest to the truth I can. And in doing so, let's just say that I've learned... You know, it's very convenient for detractors or the narrow-minded, I should say, and or the narrow-minded, to just say, oh, come on, get over it. That's bullshit. That's Elvis stuff. You know, Jim, that's urban legend. He didn't fake his death, and that you're crazy for thinking that. And that's just so unfortunate when people go there, in my opinion, you know. At least have an open-minded dialogue about it. And so I'll just say that. In the making of this film, I've learned that it's, how do we say? it is not crazy to suggest that Jim actually might have pulled the Houdini, as I like to say. And we certainly delve into that in the film. And his motivations for that. And again, a lot of these are well documented. I'm not the first one to come along. I'm taking all the available information and fine-tuning it, you know, and putting it under a microscope. And then also interacting with the audience, you know, and letting everyone draw their own conclusions. I'm not going to hit anyone over the head with anything, and you know, because I can't prove anything definitively one way or the other, unless Jim were to show up right now, you know, we can't prove anything. But along with all the other mysteries, the Morrison mysteries, and there are so many that have nothing to do with the fake death. You know, we're just playing Sherlock Holmes. I'm playing Sherlock Holmes and trying to put all the puzzle pieces together as best we can, and then let all of us interact with that puzzle. And you know, what one person may see with that puzzle may be very different from another. And I respect that. So I hope that answers your question. Was that good?
Yeah. Are you able to talk about the woman who has the story that she had worked on? Or is that you're not allowed to?
Yes. Actually, I can go there. You know what? Oh, you're talking about that woman. No, I can't. but it's in the film. It will be in the film. Let's just say that relates directly to the possibility, the notion of Jim having actually faked his death. And it's fascinating. And it's in the film.
Can you talk about the doctor? Are you allowed to say that or no?
Yes, I may. Yes, I can.
Oh my gosh.
Do you need me to pause for that?
Hold on a second. It looks like Josh is on here. Hold on.
This is exciting.
Let's see
it's
if
like
I can
a party,
get both
man.
Up here. Wait, Dory, are you still up there?
Hello.
Josh. Okay, I think I accidentally... How did I do that? Wait, hold on. I'm going to try to add
It's
both
like call
you.
Waiting when you cut someone off. You're like, damn it!
Yeah.
I need to dial
oh,
it back.
Oh, there you are. Shoot. Oh, wait. Add people to this call. Hold on, Josh. I'm going to try to add Dory again. I don't know what the heck happened.
We lost Dory. We have to
did it cut her off?
I think I accidentally...
Doom,
right,
doom,
we go.
Doom, 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 doom,
doom. Let's see. All right, so Josh, while I'm trying to get Dory on here, add to this call. Let's see if that works. Oh, there she is.
Yes!
Oh, good.
Split screen.
Oh, good, it's working. Okay, so, okay, sorry about that, Dory. Josh called in, and then I didn't know how to work. Anyway, it works now. So, Josh. Josh, are you still on there?
Yes.
Josh.
Yellow.
Josh.
The wonders of modern technology.
All right. What the heck?
All right, I'm going to try to add Josh to this one. Let's see.
Let's see what happens. We're in the middle. Yeah, we're in the middle of technology. Let's see. Add people. Okay, so we're going to try to... Yeah, there it is. Show.
Do you think one just keeps canceling the other out? Or?
God, maybe. Let's see. Okay. Okay. So, Josh. I don't know what the hell happened here.
All right. Anyway. Dory, do you have any questions about specific locations that you'd like to ask Elisa concerning where she goes and what kind of places that people can check out?
Yeah. Can you hear me still?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, I can't see anything anymore, but that's okay. It's radio. Where does your tours go?
It's about 4.5 hours. So it starts off in Hollywood.
Oh, wow.
It goes through the Sunset Strip. We go by UCLA through Venice Beach and back up to Hollywood. So it's actually pretty extensive and pretty nuanced.
Okay, so you're hitting where he went for film school and then where they played and...
Exactly. The studios, the record company, where he would hang out, where he lived with Pam, all kinds of things.
Kurt.
Yes.
The house, I don't know because I'm not from California, but the house that you showed me.
Oh, yeah.
Was that a real place?
So there's a little... So I've been hearing, Elisa, that there's this, like down Laurel Canyon, there's a little market there, and he used to live in like, this little apartment up there that had... well, when I saw it, there was a totem pole there of Jimi Hendrix, Jim Morrison, and Janis Joplin up in this window. Did he used to live up there?
He did. I've never seen the totem pole, but, yeah, he lived right behind the store. And if you listen to the lyrics of Love Street... That store is mentioned in the song.
Oh.
That's the place where the creatures meet.
Oh, that's cool.
And he says, I wonder what they do in there. So, yeah, he and Pam used to sit on the balcony and watch people come and go from the store. And actually, for a while, they were living there with another couple. And the woman was Mirandy Babbitts. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes.
Who I think you interviewed, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and... So they were splitting the rent for quite a while with another couple. It's a very expensive place to live now, but in the 60s, the rents were much lower in Laurel Canyon because it was an artist community.
That's really cool.
Yeah, I remember hearing about this a long time ago, and then
And so every time I drive past Laurel Canyon, every time I drive down there, I'm like, ooh, there's that little spot. But I never actually truly knew for sure whether it was confirmed. Oh, no, wait, actually, we were there, and you confirmed it for me, right, Jeff? That's right.
Yep, and that's also where he fooled around a little bit with Pamela DeBar, the famous groupie. She lived just up. Like
Pamela DeBar!
Yeah, she lived kind of next door, which means she lived up the hill a little bit, and she walked down to Jim's place because she could hear the Doors record playing before it came out. And she was wondering who had the demo. It turned out to be Jim himself, and she gave him some Trimar. And I don't know if you know what that is, but it's basically liquid PCP. So you put it on a hanky and you sniff it, and the high is really intense, but it doesn't stay. So they were doing Trimar, and the other Pamela came home to catch them. Pamela DeBar was in the middle of a backbend. Do you know the story? She was in the middle of a perfect backbend, and Jim was watching, and Pamela shooed Pamela number one out. And Jim chased her up the hill, and so that's the Pamela DeBar, Pamela Corson story. And I was able to ask her once, what was Pamela Corson really like? And I probably shouldn't quote her, but she said, she was a fiery bitch, but she had to be because she had to keep up with him. Right. So.
Fiery bitch.
But in fairness, if I saw my boyfriend watching another girl do a backbend in a dress, I would probably be a fiery bitch as well.
Mm-hmm. I seem to recall, wasn't she underwear free that day too?
I didn't ask her that.
I think in the telling of the story, Pamela DeBar described that she was sans underwear that time. But who knows?
She did say that when there was a confrontation between the two Pams, Jim was standing in the corner saying to himself, get it on, get it on, get it on.
Look at Elisa and I are like Paul McCartney and George Harrison on the mic.
They are. They are.
I have to say, too, real quick, I want to give a huge shout out. It's a real thrill for me today, not only to be on the show, but to be here with Elisa because she was a huge, very kind supporter of Before the End, Searching for Jim Morrison, my film, or we'll call it BTE, as we call it on the Facebook page. Very early on in the process, we met online, right? Yeah. And I had heard of LA Woman Tours, so I was familiar. And so it was real fun to have that sort of synergy there where, you know, once in a while she would promote us on her Facebook page for LA Woman Tours and vice versa. We would promote LA Woman Tours on the Before the End page. But beyond that, we struck up a rapport, you know, private messages and that kind of thing. And you were so supportive to me when I was going through some heavy shit and dealing with the Doors, powers that be, shall we say. And I always appreciated that and never forgot that. So it's a real thrill because today is the first time we're actually meeting in person. So
right.
It's very cool. And to have that come mutually through Kurt, a mutual friend for all of us, is really, really just awesome. So
I think when you find someone who's like-minded and is really trying to get to the truth and present it as authentically as possible, it just builds a natural bond, you know. So it's really exciting for me to be here with you as well, and I'm really excited to see the final cut.
Right on. Now this is where Elisa and I break into I Got You Babe and horrify everyone within the 2-block radius and worldwide streaming.
So Jeff, are there any like little nuggets of information that maybe that you know will not end up in the documentary, but you can actually still talk about things that maybe the large populace out there doesn't know about? I know you've heard bazillions. I mean, you've interviewed 700 people, did you say?
Well, communicated with 700.
Oh.
And that entails everything from, you know, phone calls, private messages, texting, you know, emails, to meeting in person at random points. I mean, it's just been an incredible journey. We keep making the running joke. My wife, Jess, who's also the co-producer on the project and helps out in just a zillion ways. So I'd like to give a huge shout out to you, Jess. Thank you. You know, we keep joking that we should make a documentary about the making of the documentary, like they did with Apocalypse Now. You know, Before the End Now, Redux. And, so, yeah, it's just been really incredible. And again, I'm grateful for all of it, the good, the bad, the hair tearing. I've earned a few gray hairs over the last few years thanks to this. But it's worth it to get to the bigger truth, you know, or truths, I should say. And as far as your specific question, stuff that's just sort of not going to make the cut, you're saying, right?
Yeah, or if it does make the cut, but stuff that maybe Doors and or Jim Morrison fans might not have learned from reading any of the books or, you know, anything like that.
Sure. Well, there's one thing that I found, and again, that's interesting because it's in the books, going back to No One Here Gets Out Alive, and, you know, it's been referenced many times. The fact that Jim, you know, everyone knows, casual fan, I suppose, and certainly hardcore fan knows that he went to Paris in March of 1971 and then allegedly died, you know, three and a half months later, July 3rd, 1971. What many sort of gloss over or may not be aware is that he went to Paris a year before that with Leon Barnard, who was a publicist for The Doors. And it's my feeling that, you know, at the risk of sounding dramatic, it was a recon mission, if you will. You know, it was basically Jim going there and scoping out the terrain and getting a feel for it, and you can, you know, let your mind go from there. But, you know, it goes on and on. There's another story that's listed in the books, going back to the original I'm touching here for Dory, our viewer of one. And, and in there, it details how when Jim and Pam, his longtime on-off girlfriend, shall we say, some say common-law wife, they had gone on a sightseeing tour, and they were in Marseille in May of 71, and Jim, as the story goes, lost his passport, his driver's license, and his wallet, which necessitated a return to Paris in the embassy there to acquire a new passport. And as anyone knows, if you get a new driver's license or a new passport, that instantly invalidates your previous one. So Jim, as the tale goes, acquired a new passport, but then the passport that was used to identify the body in the flat on July 3rd, 1971 was the original passport, which was issued in August 1968 in L.A., right here in downtown L.A., for the upcoming Doors tour of Europe, which they embarked on in September of 68. So, it's like classic Sherlock Holmes 101. You know, you do the math. Okay, so he supposedly lost the first passport, acquired a new one, which invalidated the old one, but then it was the old one, the original one, that was later used to identify the body some 6 weeks later. So what became of the new passport? Dun, dun, dun.
That's right.
The plot thickens. And we delve into that in the film, and as Jim's lover and friend Sally Stevenson, who I interview in the film, she conducted one of the last interviews Jim ever gave, a really amazing interview in October 1970. She's often said herself, "Where the hell is the new passport? What became of the new passport?" So.
Whoa.
We control the picture.
Pay no attention to the man behind that curtain. So, Dory, are there any fun facts, any things about the Doors that you think that maybe one of these two might not know about?
Oh, that these two might not know about?
Yes.
I don't know. Are we speaking just Jim Morrison or the Doors in general?
Any of them.
Well, since we have two professionals, I'd like to think you guys know a little bit about everything that's going on, but can I just say, even though it's not a question, I just want to say the entire band, besides holding him together a lot of times when he was not so put together, Ray Manzarek is an absolute genius, playing two things at once, and Robbie Krieger doing lead and rhythm, never using a pick, is an amazing feat as well. Just an incredible band all together. Of course, they needed him, but I'm a huge fan, always have been. It's got a, I don't know, I'm sure, obviously, you guys probably collect vinyl, so on Record Store Day this year, I got this new pressing, the Live at the Aquarius Theater. Have you guys heard that?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. I'm all, yeah, yes, no, maybe so. So to me, it was exciting. All the albums I have are literally released when they were released, way back when, so this is the only actual new Doors album that I have, and I was pretty excited to listen to something a little different.
Dory, can you show them the cover?
Am I on video still? I can't see you guys.
You can't see them?
We can see you.
No, okay.
That's not creepy at all for you, is it?
No, I'm like, what have I been doing? Did you see anything? what do I click so I can see you guys?
I thought, well, you don't see us at all?
I
do. You have a little video camera icon?
Little video camera icon?
There's a camera icon next to you. Wait. No, it's just gray.
Oh.
Well, if you guys can see me here, I have it next to me. I'll hold it up front, back.
I've never actually seen the vinyl, though.
Oh, nice.
Can you see it?
Is that one of the Bright Midnight issues, right? Are they still doing that?
No, I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, the label, they had their own label for a while, I think, Bright Midnight Records.
Oh, no.
Or maybe it was put out by Rhino or something.
That's what I had assumed, you know, and I didn't even check. Very interesting. The vinyl itself, so there's four sides, but it is clear vinyl.
Oh, wow.
Lovely transparent.
Yeah, good sound. That's so crazy you guys have seen me all this time. And I've
You know, you bring up a really great point, Dory, and that is the unique sound of the Doors and the talent of all four members. And I think the other three guys sometimes get overlooked when we're talking about Jim Morrison. He gets all the attention, but the Doors wouldn't be the Doors if it wasn't for all four of them. And I think Jim would probably be the first one to say that and give them credit. You know, Jim, for one thing, in addition to his lyrics, which we always talk about, his voice is unique in rock and roll because he's a baritone. And usually in popular music, we hear men singing in a tenor. And, you know, there's no bass player. Ray handles all of that, and it's a very, it's a unique sounding keyboard. Robbie Krieger was heavily inspired by flamenco music, and of course, John Densmore was inspired by all kinds of things and learned how to play in school, but was really into jazz and Latin music. So when these elements all come together, they produce a sound that no one has been able to replicate since then, and I think that's part of what makes them timeless, because no one sounds like them. They don't sound of their era, and if someone is sounding like the Doors, it's because they're trying to sound like the Doors. They're their own thing. That's the only way I can really put it. I don't know if Jeff wants to say anything.
Oh, yeah, I would absolutely firmly agree with that. I mean, they were, you know, they were an archetype unto themselves. I mean, and as one of the guys I interview in my film, who went to film school with them, John Patak, he said, you know, you got to keep in mind the context. You know, 1966, 67, when they first, you know, hit, there was no YouTube, there was no internet even. You couldn't just dial up, you know, and see what other bands were doing. He said, you know, each band was sort of cut from whole cloth. The only way you could really get a vibe as to what other bands were doing in your area, you know, like L.A. or San Francisco, were to go to L.A. or San Francisco and see them live, you know. And I think that's really, really important to keep in mind, you know. And so just the amalgam, you know, like Kurt and I were talking earlier, the amalgam of the stew, you know, that made up the Doors sound, like, everything from, you know, cabaret, you know, opera, jazz, surf music, flamenco, you know, blues, hard rock. I mean, just on and on, acid rock, even, you know, it's just, and they were, most people, that's something I like to delve into in my film, is how they were a precursor to punk. You know, like, a lot of people love to rip on the Doors because, unfortunately, they've, in many quarters, they've become sort of this, you know, running joke or caricature, and it's easy to make fun of these things, you know. Like I said to one of Jim's friends, you know, the Velvet Underground retains all this cred, you know, this cred, like credibility, underground credibility and street credibility with college radio, and why not the Doors? You know, obviously, a cynic would say, oh, because they sold so many more units than the Velvets, you know, so it's easier to poke fun at the bigger fish, you know, this kind of thing. But, you know, Jim really was, and in particular in the Doors in general, like a huge influence on what later became punk 10 years later. And Iggy Pop, you know, if you Google Iggy Pop, Jim Morrison, or going to YouTube and punch in Iggy Pop, Jim Morrison, you will see a number of interviews where Iggy is just, you know, making no bones about the fact that Jim hugely inspired him. And in fact, you know, Iggy was there in October 1967 at the University of Michigan's homecoming where the Doors played, and he saw Jim fucking with the crowd in a huge way, and he said, I want to do that. And you know, many people cite Iggy as the father of punk, so if he's the father, then Jim's the godfather, you know, in my opinion.
The godfather.
Right. And actually, you touched on something kind of important, which is to go back to the era in which the Doors came out of, and you did have to go see the bands in person. And most people don't realize that when the Doors first started out, they had trouble getting a gig, which is hard to imagine now because we think of them as this, not only a classic band, but as the quintessential Sunset Strip 1960s band, because they were the house band for that one summer at the Whiskey A Go-Go, but for a while they couldn't get arrested, basically. And it was because they didn't sound like anyone else, and no one knew what to do with them. And I think this kind of touches on their counterparts or their colleagues, however you want to call them, but the band Love, who were probably the most popular band in Los Angeles at the time, and we don't hear much about them now. But what Jeff was saying is you had to go see a band. Love was the most successful band in Los Angeles, but their singer, Arthur Lee, would not leave Los Angeles. So they never became a huge sensation that they probably should have been. When Jack Holzman, the president of Elektra Records, came out to Los Angeles to start an office on the West Coast, he wanted a Sunset Strip band because he knew that's where everything was happening. He thought it was Love. He wasn't impressed at first with the Doors. And so he put all of his energy into Love, but they would not tour outside of Los Angeles. And it was the Doors who exploded and not Love. And by the way, it was Arthur Lee of Love who recommended the Doors to Jack Holzman.
Wow.
So there's a big triangle between the Doors, Love, and Jack Holzman. And on paper, Love was the band that should have made it, not the Doors.
That's crazy. Dory, listen, I hate to cut you out, but I have got to, I want to try to get Josh on here. I can't figure out how to get both of you on here. So, because we have like 15 minutes left here.
Okay, can I ask one more question?
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
On your tour, and I'm sure this is true, I don't know that I'm verifying it's true, but did the Doors not get the gig at the Whiskey because the talent scout had a crush on Jim?
As far as I understand it, that's what happened. She walked down to the London Fog a couple doors down and liked what she saw. And I don't blame her, you know, but unless Jeff has heard something different, that story's true. Her name was Ronnie Heron. And and as far as I know, she's the one who kind of helped Jim with his image as well. She dressed him.
Right, very nice.
I was going to follow up on that real quick. I agree with Alisa, and you know, it's fascinating to consider all the variables, the way things could have gone. If Ronnie Heron hadn't had a huge crush on Jim, would we be sitting here talking about them? If the band Love with Arthur Lee, if the singer Arthur Lee did decide to tour outside Los Angeles? Would things have gone differently? You know, you just, it's those little thoughts that are really fun to consider, you know, in terms of the points on the curve, you know, in the lineage of the Doors story. So it's really fun, fascinating stuff.
All right, Kurt, well, I'll let you go so you can get your brother on, and I'll listen to the archive to see what I missed, and thank you very much for having me on, and nice to meet you guys via technology.
Thank you.
Nice to meet you, too.
Look forward to your movie. I look forward to your film for sure, and next summer I'll come out and do one of your tours.
I can't wait to meet you.
Okay, sounds great.
Thanks for being on.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, folks, we are going to play a fun little song. This is a, I found Alabama song online, sung by David Bowie, and I thought maybe David Bowie had inspired Jim Morrison to sing it, but then in the version that I saw him singing, it mentioned Bertolt Brecht and Kurt Weill, so I'm going to play that song so you guys can hear that version. Sounds pretty cool, so here we go.
Oh, show us the way to the next whiskey bar.
Oh, don't ask why. Oh, don't ask why.
Oh, we must find the next whiskey bar. Oh, if we don't find the next whiskey bar.
I tell you we must die. I tell you we must die. I tell you, we must die.
Oh, Alabama, we now must say goodbye. We have lost our good old mama, and must have we seen.
Scottish weddings, because it is the color of fairies and an omen of revenge. It is considered unlucky to even eat green vegetables at a Scottish wedding. Stay tuned to Inspirato Projecto for more fun facts.
Yeah,
Folks, we are back. Now, what I'm going to try to do here is we're going to try to call Josh, my dear brother. He's a huge Jim Morrison and Doors fan, and I really wanted to try to get him on here. I want to try to get him on here because he's such a huge fan. And
Jeff and I are geeking out.
Oh yeah, they're busy geeking out on their.
We're looking at the original Doors tour program.
Ooh.
Which are hard to come by.
You know, I have to tell you, on one of my tours, my friend Jonathan, who does the Venice Beach tours, came on my tour. And he brought a friend of mine, or a friend of his, who was a Doors fan. And this guy, his name is Spencer. And he owns the bail bond from the Miami incident.
Oh, nice.
And I have never wanted to see something so bad in my life. I don't know what he paid for it. He got it at auction, I think. But, he owns the actual bail bond from the Miami incident.
Did you get a chance to see it?
No, he didn't bring it. He didn't think to bring it, but Jonathan mentioned, "Oh, my friend Spencer has the bail bond from Miami." I'm like, "And you didn't show and tell? Why? What are you thinking? You come here, and you didn't bring it?" So ever since then, I've been obsessed with Jonathan's friend Spencer and the bail bond.
It's so kick-ass, all those little tiny little bits of information that you're like, oh my gosh, I would love to have seen that thing, or would love to have seen that thing. And like you were talking earlier, Jeff, about how one of the greatest concerts was never actually videotaped or anything.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be, you know, largely the consensus that the shows the Doors did in March of 1968 at the Fillmore East in New York, Bill Graham ran the Fillmore East just as he did the Fillmore West in San Francisco. And the Doors did a series of shows there that just seemed to represent the zenith, you know, the peak of them at the height of their creative powers as a live band. And it was shortly after that, that was like March 22nd, 1968, there was a number of back-to-back shows over 2 days. And shortly thereafter, in mid-May of 68, Jim chopped all his hair off with his own hand, and in my opinion was, you know, self-sabotaging his, you know, the famous Lizard King image we all know, and just the image of a rock star in general. And, you know, and not long after that, you know, onward we go. I mean, he wanted out of the band. There was the Buick incident, which I can get into if we have enough time later. But you can Google Jim Morrison, Buick, and oh, it's interesting. And then shortly after Buick came the Miami incident, which, again, you Google Jim Morrison, Doors, Miami, and it's all there. So, yeah, fascinating lineage.
So when you say incident, it sounds to me like... Did it seem like he tried to have these incidents, or did he accidentally fall into these incidents, or do you think he was trying to carefully sculpt his exit strategy, so to speak?
It's my feeling that Jim was orchestrating every move consciously. You know, we have this mainstream media perpetuated image of him as this zoned out, stoned out, drunken guy 24/7, and he was a brilliant guy, and it's not to say that wasn't part of him, you know, getting fucked up or partying or whatever, but it's not who he was 24/7, so I think he really was just a brilliant guy and conscious of every movie he made. And but, you know, specifically to answer that question, the incidents I mentioned, you know, the Buick incident was something that happened to him. The Miami incident was something of his own design. He was very much pulling the strings on that one. So, again, I don't know how much time we have. I don't want to get too much into the details, but for those listening, yeah, if you Google Jim Morrison, Buick, Doors, you'll see what that entailed. Same thing with Jim Morrison, Doors, Miami. And these were huge, huge moments on the... If you're doing the points on the curve of Jim's life, these were big catalysts in terms of motivating him to eventually want out of the Doors, want out of rock stardom, want to get away from everything, transcend everything, and his eventual move to Paris.
So we now have basically 5 minutes left. Okay, I know on that clock it's a little different. So we have 5 minutes left. Thank you, Nicholas, for letting us. By the way, we got Nicholas here, our station manager.
Woo!
And behind.
Hi.
He's the Captain Kirk of the spaceship here. He's always so reliable, and he's like the guy that you see in the Star Trek episodes. He's like pushing the buttons. And you're going, what is he pushing the buttons? What is, does he know what he's doing? But yeah, he totally knows what he's doing every single time because.
I'm giving her all she's got, Captain.
Is there any song that you guys want to hear? I'm looking on YouTube right now. Any specific Doors song, maybe a rarity or something like that, that maybe you'd like me to search and play?
I don't know why, but I've always been really fond of Take It As It Comes.
All right. Let's see what we got here, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, see, now this is a 2006 remastered. We probably don't want a remastered one, right? Let's see. Let's see if this is the original one. Here, I'll go down to this one. Let's see what happens here.
We'll be right back.
You just heard. Girl, couldn't we get much better? No, that was Break On Through. Before that, we heard, what was the song, Elisa?
Take It As It Comes.
Ah, so we figured we might as well play a couple of Doors songs on today's edition. Any last little piece of information either of you two would like to say before we sign off here?
I guess the main thing I would like to emphasize is don't believe everything that you read, especially when it comes to someone as complicated as Jim Morrison or even the whole band. And, you know, I alluded to a building being torn down earlier. Since I started doing the tours just a few years ago, we've lost several buildings. And if I could just implore people to go out and explore your own environment, your own neighborhood, be a tourist. Don't be shy about being a tourist in your own neighborhood and see what's out there for yourself and interact with the environment, because tomorrow it literally might not be there. And it's our heritage. It's our legacy as Angelinos.
God, that's amazing.
Amen, sister. I absolutely agree with Elisa, what she just said, and I hope you guys take it to heart. And I would riff on that and say, not only don't believe everything you read about Jim and the Doors, or anything for that matter, you know, question everything, and even question yourself. Don't believe everything you think.
Jim would want you to.
Yeah, I mean, just don't follow the status quo, because you don't know if it's legit or not. But and then, yeah, I guess I want to thank Kurt and
Nicholas
and Elisa and everyone at K-Chung and the listeners. And this is my second time here, and I really appreciate it. It's been just a blast. And again, the film is called Before the End, Searching for Jim Morrison. You can just Google that. That'll take you to our official BTE Facebook page and the official website and all that good stuff. And the updates are there, best found on the Facebook page. And LAWomanTours.com, right?
Yep.
So LAWomanTours.com for Elisa's tour. And Before the End, Searching for Jim Morrison. And I think you'll see two sides of Jim that you don't see every day in the mainstream media, which is sort of, shall we say, conditioned by the brand, Jim Morrison, the brand. This tour and this film will help you transcend that brand and get to the real human being.
Ooh, I love it. Okay, you guys, thank you for coming on. Thank you again, Nicholas, for the great times here.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Kurt.
You're welcome. We are now signing off.